Blighted Nation with Miles Dungan on RTE Radio 1. Episode 4. Does Ireland still bear the scars of the famine?
A cafe is a great place to indulge in some people watching. It's a place where psychologist Tricia McDonnell likes to observe certain behaviours and habits that are peculiar to we Irish. Like the way we fight over who gets to pay for the coffee.
There's a couple of women over there at the till, and you can see that they're kind of pushing money back at each other with frantic gestures, obviously being very polite about who's going to take the bill.
Or even the way we say sorry.
You can see people actually over there have just passed each other on a narrow little passageway there and bumped into each other, and both people said sorry, but in a very self-effacing kind of, oh, sorry.
Tricia feels that these and other over-polite habits, like our inability to be direct and say yes when we're asked if we'd like a cup of tea, go back to harsh times of oppression or famine.
We just really want to be seen as nice with each other. I think the being nice to each other goes back to actually needing to band together to survive, and that would have been pre-famine, it would have been just around the Cromwellian invasion and colonisation.
She also thinks it formed the beginnings of our drinking culture.
That is a direct result of not being able to say anything directly to people and needing the excuse of being drunk to say what you need to say without causing offence, because you can say the next day, oh, I'm sorry, well, that was just the drink talk and I don't feel like that at all.
In this hour, we ask, has our culture been shaped by colonialism and the famine? How did it influence our attitudes to things like the Catholic Church and owning property? And are we still a scarred nation?
None of it is taught, but being around other people doing it all the time, you do it too. It's almost osmosis.
I'm joined by Kevin Whelan, Professor of History at Notre Dame University in Dublin, writer Colm Tobin and social historian Cathal Porter. So the starvation officially lasted 7 years, but Kevin, are the effects still with us?
I would certainly think so. The famine was what turned Ireland from being a bilingual culture into an increasingly monolingual English-speaking one. It impacted Catholicism, it impacted nationalism, it impacted our relationship with Britain, it created massively our kind of diaspora, and in so many ways the legacy of it is still with us.
Cathal, do you agree?
I would, and I suppose another element that has to be mentioned would be emigration, which had started before the famine, but which became a huge outflow, and the population didn't recover until a few years ago, and that may only have been a brief recovery.
Colm, are the effects still with us?
Yes, I think we live with the silences, but we also live with the results. I think a society was built on it as much as a society was destroyed by it.
Well, let's lie Mother Ireland on the couch and have her analysed by the experts. Galette Kinsella asked psychiatrists, a psychologist and a scientist to apply their expertise to history.
Famine is bad for your health.
Of course, we all know that death by starvation is long, drawn out and horrible. And we also know that even if your great-great-grandparents survived the famine, their health would have been badly affected by things like
poor nutrition and infectious diseases.
But science is now telling us that those ill health effects might have lingered well beyond your great-great-grandparents. And the famine might also be affecting you. And as science writer Sean Duke explains here, it's all wrapped up in a new word, epigenetics.
We know that DNA, of course, dictates our eye colour, our height, even our personality. And for years, people have thought that it's totally set in stone, that that's the only factor that governs our inheritance or what we're like, our personality.
But now they believe there's another layer on top of the DNA or genome called the epigenome.
And that controls the DNA in response to things that happen in the environment, usually very stressful things like famine.
So, for example, if a woman is pregnant during a time of famine, the epigenomes sitting on top of her baby's DNA will switch certain genes on and off in response to the mother's environment. And these changes will stay with the child for its entire life. But when scientists followed up on women who'd been pregnant during the Dutch hunger winter of 1944, where 22,000 people died of starvation, they found that it went even further, as explained here by Dr. Brendan Kelly, who's a consultant psychiatrist with the Mater Hospital.
So, for example, a baby girl born in 1944 or 1945, she would have been a low birth weight baby, most likely owing to famine conditions. But what's very interesting is that when she in turn goes on to have a child, her baby is likely to also have a low birth weight, even though that particular baby has not been exposed to famine conditions at any point.
Scientists also discovered that lots of epigenetic changes lingered in a population long after a trauma was over. Things like predisposition to cardiovascular disease, or even a shorter lifespan. But when they measured stress levels in Holocaust survivors and their families living in New York, scientists found something interesting. Direct survivors had high levels of the stress hormone cortisol in their bodies.
Also their children, which isn't a big surprise because that's a direct connection, physical connection.
The real surprise is that it continued into the third generation, which has some far-reaching consequences.
Not only are the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors more stressed than they should be, they're also more prone to things like PTSD, to anxiety and lots of other effects.
That brings up some interesting questions about our own health.
Maybe there is a reason why there is more schizophrenia located in the west of Ireland. Maybe just theoretically it has something to do with the lingering epigenetic effect of a trauma like the famine.
But for a lot of people, the impacts of the famine go well beyond mere biology and into the realm of psychology.
Okay, I want to talk about Ireland. We're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Look at all our old men in the pubs. Look at all our young people on drugs.
For centuries before the trauma of the Great Famine, generations of people had continuously been degraded and depicted by the British as useless, annoying children.
And lots of people observed, even before the famine, how absolutely poor and starving the Irish people were of resources as well as food.
Which is why clinical psychologist Dr. Tricia MacDonald feels that by the time the famine happened, the Irish had learned to be helpless. And in the same way an individual develops techniques to cope with trauma, Irish people developed strategies to cope with this helplessness. And these techniques, says Dr. MacDonald, have become a firm part of Irish culture.
As an individual, if you have post-traumatic stress, you do learn how to manage it. Some people get into a very aggressive way of challenging it, or other people withdraw.
That withdrawal can lead to avoiding confrontation or shying away from making uncomfortable decisions.
We do have avoidance stuff. We export our problems.
What Dr. MacDonald is saying is that those learned personality traits and ways of surviving are still with us 160 years on. But she feels it goes even further.
When you're so powerless and you've learned helplessness and you're uneducated, there is an easy jump to feeling like you deserve what comes your way.
And this feeling that you deserve what comes your way is what Dr. Garrett O'Connor calls malignant shame. He's a psychiatrist and former head of the Betty Ford Clinic. And this shame has some pretty nasty symptoms.
Self-loathing, self-criticism. You don't seem to be as good as anybody else, but you have to pretend.
And after centuries of passing on this shame from one generation to the next, it becomes fairly enmeshed in our sense of identity.
Well, identity is very hard to eradicate, especially the identity that comes with the need to survive. Once that seed begins to get sown, it's very hard to eradicate, and it continues.
And that shame, says Dr. MacDonald, prevents us from really believing we can achieve great things.
Years and years of history teaching us that bad after bad after bad happening sets you up not being able to trust anything that seems to be good.
I see the Irish as a race like a child that got itself bashed in the face. And if there ever is going to be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding.
We stand on the brink of a great achievement.
But the big question now is, can we move on from here? Dr. MacDonald believes we can.
Everybody knows what we do. That isn't necessarily good for us. But it's an unconscious process now. It's almost like a reflex response. I think bringing that to consciousness and learning other potential responses is a start.
We are all Irish, all our different kinds of ways. We must not, now or ever in the future, shy
show anything to each other except tolerance, forbearance, and neighborly love.
Is that all pushing an event which happened 170 years ago a little bit too far, reading a little bit too much into it, or would you agree with the main points of that package?
It's extremely problematic to extrapolate from a kind of a general social and cultural phenomenon to the individual phenomenon. I think the wider field of psychoanalysis and others would resist that very, very thoroughly. But the really important thing is whether or not the social, political, cultural structures which emerged as a result of the famine then created a context in which particular forms of behaviour or other things emerged. It's not like that there is a kind of a genetic or psychological kind of predisposition to this. And as we know, a huge amount of how we perform and how we operate in life comes from our own kind of disposition. And I think that that's much more helpful way of kind of looking at it than kind of saying somehow that we're all just little puppets which are still being kind of pulled on strings back from the 1840s.
Colm, the traits that were mentioned by Tricia MacDonald, the psychologist there, our deferential attitude to authority, our tendency to avoid the truth, our failure to speak plainly and assertively, do you think they are related to the famine, or are they perhaps related to our colonial background?
Well, I suppose our will work there if you include Scotland, if you include Newfoundland, if you include various parts of Australia. In other words, there are many parts of the world in which people have these feelings and which you can notice in a pub or in the street. These sort of things, and people don't claim that these are a result of a famine that occurred in those countries. So, I mean, I think that's just far too easy to say that results in that, and that we in Ireland are unique in some way or other, even in our funny, odd habits, that you find that those odd habits occur in other countries too.
Colm, one of the things that you mentioned yourself there, Miles, was the colonial aspect of it, and to take a particular event like the famine and to argue that that would be the origin of a number of things, including personal characteristics, you know, I think you could probably more legitimately argue that the sum total of colonialism may have taught attitudes and ingrained attitudes into society, which still remain. But I think it's a different thing altogether to say that because of the famine that we as individuals react in certain ways.
OK, just to move on and to look at changes that took place. In the years after the famine, the country was traumatised, but there were those who could see a silver lining in that cloud. People like William Stuart Trench. He was a controversial character, a land agent, and the author of a book called The Realities of Irish Life. In 1868, he published a list of positives he considered had come out of the famine.
It hurried the introduction of free trade. It indirectly brought about arterial drainage of many of the main rivers of Ireland. It created the Land Improvement Act. It brought into existence the Encumbered Estates Court, one of the most important acts ever passed in Ireland. It drove some millions of people to the other side of the Atlantic and sent many thousands to an untimely grave. It broke up, to a great extent, the small farms of Ireland. It relieved the plethora of the labour market. It removed the needy country gentlemen and forced them to sell their estates into the hands of capitalists. It unlocked the millions of capital since then laid out on the improved cultivation of the land. It brought over hundreds of Scotchmen and Englishmen who have farmed on an extended and more scientific system than had been the practice in Ireland. And, in short, it has produced a revolution in the country that has lasted ever since.
Kevin, there's no doubt about the role the famine played in the modernisation of Ireland, but at the expense of a million lives.
Yes, and I suppose that's fundamentally what we'd want to say when you're talking about this, that there's over a million people who actually died. And they're fundamentally the primary kind of victims of the famine. You can then say there's a secondary group, which is maybe another 2 million or so who within the famine period and the decade after it emigrated. And, you know, that 3 million actually quite closely matches the 3 million people in the pre-famine period who'd become utterly dependent on the potato. But that loss, that disappearance, that collapse of population is one of the central facts of the famine. And in some respects, once you move away from that to look at what happened to the kind of survivors, in some respects, I think you can neglect that central element. That's 1 million lost lives there, each of whom was a warm, leaving individual human being with mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and lovers and friends and school companions and whatever, who are literally kind of obliterated. It's as if the population of the city of Dublin within a decade had absolutely and completely kind of vanished. I think that's really where the long-term impact comes.
Carl, landscape and land use in Ireland looked utterly different after the famine than it did before, didn't it?
Yeah, well, you can still see it in certain parts of the country. If you look up into the hills, you'll still see the signs of the lazy bed cultivation that was used for potato cultivation, because the growth in population in the generation or two generations before the famine saw people push up into areas and out into areas that hadn't been brought into agricultural use of any type before that because of the poor quality of the land. But the population growth and the need to sustain people by growing potatoes, you can see it everywhere you look, and that is still there on the landscape to be seen.
And the labouring class removed, as Kevin was saying, and absolutely massive emigration, and a shift also away from tillage to pasture in Ireland.
Yeah, well, that whole class disappeared. It was wiped out. The houses that they were in are gone. The people were gone. They were the ones who mostly didn't even make the ships to emigrate. They were the no-cash economy.
Was it the end of feudalism, Colm, and the beginnings of capitalism? And that's one of the things that William Stuart Trench essentially is talking about.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to see it as a watershed, but you have to be very careful with that. For example, Enniscorthy Cathedral was designed by Pugin, who was the greatest church architect of the age. How come in 1845 and 1846, Catholics in Enniscorthy could afford to bring in Pugin and design that cathedral? It cost absolute fortune to build. Was it famine work? No, it wasn't. It was done by the merchants of Enniscorthy who were Catholic. If you trace who paid for the cathedral, if you trace their descendants, you find that they owned shops in 1845, that they were already trading very well. There was already a Catholic middle class in 1845, 1846. What you have in the famine is an erasure, is the removal of an underclass, but that the actual overclass, who were Catholics, then consolidated their position further by, for example, who were the middlemen? Obviously, the people who made money, you know, in grain and all those, were all Catholics who used that capital for further consolidation of their position. So I think you have to remember that it wasn't as though there was nothing in 1845, and out of that nothing, a middle class grew.
Kevin?
It's the same way the other victims of the famine, which we sometimes don't think about, and I think this is really important as well, were the landlord class and the whole kind of superstructure within Irish society. Because in a sense, when the British reviewed the famine, they criticised the Irish poor, for sure. But the other group that they were absolutely hostile towards was the Irish landlords, who they thought were responsible for creating this massive poverty. And the Irish landlord class is then ruthlessly eliminated by the British state in the second half of the 19th century. As a result of that, the top of the society is removed, the bottom third of the society is removed. You're then left with a very homogenous and rather narrow kind of social group in the middle, and they become what Emmet Larkin once called the nation-forming class.
Before the famine, I think it was fairly common for farmers to subdivide land between their sons. So farms got smaller and smaller and smaller. That practice disappeared more or less after the famine. Yeah. What effect did that have?
First of all, I want to say the subdivision is completely misunderstood by historians. Because subdivision wasn't the case where you had, say, a 100-acre farm and then you divided, you had two sons and then you made 50 acres and then you had those had two sons and you made 25 acres. It didn't work like that. Subdivision occurred within what was called communal lease. So, if you, say, had a townland in the west of Ireland, rather than, there being 15 different farms, what they did was there was 15 of them who had a communal lease. They ran the thing on what was called infield, outfield. You had a kind of a clocking or clustered kind of settlement. There was very strict environmental rules about how you did it. You know, the cow's grass, how much you could graze, how much of it would be for potatoes. It was kind of managed semi-communally, but with individual rights within it. And it was the rights within that system that were divided, not that you had 20 acres, which then became 10 acres. But what it was you had 1/20 of the grazing, you had 1/20 of the turf, you had 1/20 of the shoreline, you know, to gather seaweed on. The potato allowed these rundale systems to become very, very large. So, you know, when you're talking then about what happened in the post-famine period, what happens is the clockens and the communal system are wiped out. In the west of Ireland then, the farms are striped and reorganised, largely by state intervention. In the east, what happened was really the elimination of the cottiers, the agricultural labourers, a different kind of process altogether. And again, if you took a 100-acre farm in Wexford or Tipperary or Kilkenny, what you would find is on any of those farms, there's small little holdings, cottiers and whatever, who are disappeared, but who are, as it were, absorbed into the kind of big farm structure. And then in turn, that big farm structure powers the very significant kind of Catholic re-emergence which occurs in the second half of the 19th century.
Carl, what about the silence that followed the famine? How pronounced was that?
It's difficult to answer in one way, but the work that the Irish Folklore Commission did was they actually asked people, do you know about this? And I think we may talk about the great silence about the famine and that people didn't want to talk about it, but maybe they didn't talk about it because people didn't ask about it. Because the small number of field workers that the Irish Folklore Commission had collected thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of people willing to talk about the famine.
Well, let's now hear some of those memories as told by people who grew up surrounded by the physical and psychological legacy of the famine.
I heard several accounts of the misery and wretchedness of the people who gathered about the Killarney workhouse, moaning and groaning with the hunger, and the cartloads of corpses wending their way to the paupers' graveyard in the neighbourhood.
The Caseys lived up at the bottom of the mountain. The ruin is still there. There were seven or eight of them there. The oldest girl went the 6 days of the week to Sneem for soup, Prishach, and came empty. On the seventh day, five of them died. Years after, my father was ditching near the ruin, and he found the bones. An old man and a child. The arm of the old man was wound around the child.
Long ago, I remember to have heard, when I was young, how a poor woman was found dead in the parish of King Williamstown. She was found on the roadside with a poor, miserable child trying to suck at the dead breasts of the mother, and the mouth of the poor corpse was smeared with green slime to show that the poor woman was existing on grass and weeds.
There's an old ruin there across the river where a whole family died. They died of fever. They had to knock the house down on them, and the dogs drew away their bodies. There were several cases back there in Dirin and Vurig where whole families were buried in the fields.
Heartbreaking stories there gathered by the Irish Folklore Commission in the mid-1940s. Famine memories from those who lived through its aftermath as featured on RTE Radio's Famine Echoes. Tales of destitution and death are widespread in local memory, but the famine also sounded the death knell of bankrupt landlords. The value of estates tumbled and they were auctioned off. Colm, who got the land?
This new class emerged, which I suppose has given us Fine Gael, for example, and elements of the Fianna Fáil party also in the new state. I suppose what was strange was the idea then that somehow or other we were all in this together, that we could use the word we about the nation, when the nation had been so openly and deeply divided, east, west, but also a group of people who were simply removed from being even tenants on estates and maybe just workers on bigger farms. We somehow or other created nationalism as a way of avoiding the fact that great divisions had taken place. I suppose you get a notion of a nation which is almost classless, which is absolutely filled with class.
But on the property one, it is important, though, again, to say that one of the responses delayed to the famine was the Land League. And when the Land League started with Davitt and with political direction from Parnell, their key thing was, you know, to keep a grip on your holdings, not to allow yourselves now, as Davitt said many times, to be dispossessed as our fathers were during the famine. And that then did create the kind of transition from a kind of a tenantry to a landholding group. And that's where you could say that, you know, there, if there's a kind of a famine legacy or a famine shadow, there is that in terms of the fact that, you know, we do have, whether you like it or not, historically, we do have now one of the highest rates of home ownership, or at least mortgage-assisted home ownership in the world, at close to 80%. There's certainly a very strong emphasis within Irish society on the idea of owning or having your own kind of place and maintaining the family. So few Irish families could actually stay in the land, and it had been fractured by emigration and other kind of things. We still tend to look at the emigration statistics as really being more important, even say, than how we're doing economically or otherwise.
One of the statistics is that only one in three people born in, say, 1831 died in the same place, and in Munster it was just one in four. That huge social disruption, displacement, that may well have left a mark, which would carry into the hope of property ownership and establishing a base and keeping a family together.
I come from a family of 12, and my own mother's proudest boast was that none of her children had emigrated. Now, what kind of culture is that?
Yeah.
I want to bring in the diaspora, because Ireland obviously was a very different place after the famine. Our population went from 8.2 million in 1841, could have gone up to 8.5 million by 1845, but it was 6 million a decade later. At least 1 million people had died, the rest had emigrated. Today, about 72 million people worldwide claim some Irish descent. Up to 40 million Americans claim Irish as their primary ethnicity, although it's not something they've always shouted about from the rooftops, as Nicolene Greer discovered when she went to New York for this programme.
We think they were from Kilkenny. They came in 1847, but we don't know a lot about them, and I think that's very common among descendants of famine immigrants in the United States.
You know, I don't know anything about it. She did, when she marries this other man, he's another Irish immigrant. I can't find him coming in to this country.
My grandfather, I'm not really sure how he got here, but somehow he arrived. Because, you know, we all don't know exactly the complete history.
Once you get back to a certain level, trying to find a Sullivan family in Ireland is kind of hard.
There's no surviving paperwork beyond death certificates. There are no stories. Nobody had any folk stories from Ireland.
It's a story that you hear from many famine immigrants in New York. We don't know much about them. The Irish Hunger Memorial in New York consists of a cottage that once stood in County Mayo. Brian Klein is a New Yorker whose grandmother lived in that cottage. For him, it's a source of pride, but he thinks it would not be for other members of the family.
Definitely a romantic notion for those of us who are a few generations, well, many generations removed. But I did ask my godmother what she thought that my grandmother and my, you know, her relatives would have said, or, you know, her sort of sister-in-law would have said. She said, I think that they would have been quite ashamed. And I said, really, it's quite, I'm shocked by that. And she said, well, the way her mother put it, so why on earth would they want to see where we came from? So I think even that many generations removed from the famine, this was this sort of like shame that some of, at least my grandmother's generation, still kept with them.
Novelist Peter Quinn is descended from famine immigrants and has written about the famine immigrant experience. He resorted to fiction to find out about his ancestors because so little of the history was passed down through his family.
I call it this great silence that overfell the famine experience, because so much of it was painful and so much of it involved failure. And especially immigrants, you don't want to give those stories to your children. You want to give, it's a coinage you can't use, and you want the coinage of success. And my own mother, who her mother was a maid, none of my grandparents got out of grammar school, and my parents went to college, which was, you know, an amazing thing. They came to America, and they did find the life that they were seeking. But a lot of their cousins and brothers and sisters didn't. But we didn't. They didn't want us to have those stories. And my mother was a great, she could have been, worked with Joseph Stalin for destroying records. She was always tearing up photographs and birth certificates. Well, you don't want to know that. She said to me, because I was getting interested when she was an old woman in all this history, and she says, what do you want that baggage for? You know, some people would say your legacy. Well, in my mother's mind, this was like trunks, immigrant trunks filled with stuff you didn't want anymore. Bad stories, failure, people who didn't make it. And that was another thing I realized, that I began to look back. I said, God, I'm at the end of this long journey, you know. It really is an epic journey out of these villages into the cities, into this whole different life. And there were a lot of people on the roadside. A lot of people just left there or died or were buried in unmarked graves. And I didn't have their names, but I suddenly had this sense of, yeah, that's what I come out of, this great journey that began through, as a result of this famine, this catastrophe that overwhelmed Ireland in the 19th century.
Now, Now, we heard reference there again to the great silence, in this case amongst the emigrant population. Colm, why did they not want to remember? You've quite a bit of experience of being amongst descendants of emigrants and writing about them. Are we talking here about survivor guilt of some kind? Are we talking about a sense of failure? What's it about?
The novelist Henry James, his grandfather, came from Ballybor to America about the turn of the century. He made a fortune until the famine. That idea of being Irish was being Presbyterian, was coming to America with capital, with some capital, with literacy and looking for religious rights and also to make a fortune. But once 1847 comes and the Irish arrive after the famine, the James's position absolutely changes. They don't want to be Irish. In Henry James's autobiography written, really when he was in his 60s, he claims to have English ancestry, which he didn't in fact have, and he knew he didn't have, but he was living in London. The level of which, for example, I've worked in Princeton, I work in Columbia, the level of which you have now for the first time, you have kids with Irish names. You did not have it even 20 years ago. That the stigma of having an Irish name in America was that you would not, I mean, obviously the Kennedy became president, but that you would not hold power in many areas of American society if you were of Irish origin. And that remains a very much a part of being an Irish American to this day. I mean, people are proud of it because America is a funny melting pot society, but nonetheless, on the east coast of America, to be Irish is to be oddly powerless and oddly conscious of your position.
Yeah. It's only from the 1990s when Irish America finally breached through to the very top end of society and they're in the country clubs and there's, you know, they're running the big companies and whatever. It's only then they kind of start to look back and kind of say, how did we get here and what is the kind of trajectory?
Yeah, it's taken a long time. Sometimes I walk through the library and I'm looking for something and I realise, of course, it's not there. That there's a silence not only from the famine, but from Ireland itself within the power structures of the United States, and that you see it in the books the librarian didn't think were worthy of attention.
Kevin, I have to ask you how emigrants fed back into Irish society and Irish politics in the decades following the famine.
There was tiny return emigration. So when people went, they went with the expectation that there was no coming back. And the women went as well as the men. Over 50% of what went were women. And that's unique in terms of 19th century emigration studies. The only thing that did come back, and even then probably unsuccessfully, was that the Irish create one of the first kind of diasporic nationalist networks. But it's surprisingly weak in terms of its impact within Irish culture, because Irish culture itself has moved in a different direction. And again, if you're thinking about memory, it stands to reason, doesn't it, that you know, the people who would have the most bitter memories of the famine are those who were forced, as they saw it, to emigrate. And it was they who harboured, in some respects, the most virulent, the most aggressively Anglophobic and the most bitter memories of the famine.
OK, I want to move it on to talk a little bit about religion and the effect of the famine on the Catholic religion. Irish people apparently did not show a lot of interest in the Catholic Church before the famine, but the aftermath of the famine saw a huge boom in devotion. Colm, would you put that down to a belief perhaps that the famine was the wrath of God and divine punishment for the sins of the nation?
No, I wouldn't really. I mean, I put it down to the fact that there was more money available. As I said, Enniscorthy Cathedral was built in 1845. The church was beginning to consolidate its own position. In a vacuum, it will always be filled. And the vacuum was filled by the church almost as a substitute for industrialization, which would give the church a sort of power that maybe industry had in other countries in Europe.
Yes. If we come to the famine and to understand the role of Catholicism within that, I think we have to say one simple way of expressing it, and this would be, the argument of Emmett Larkin in Chicago in a famous article called The Devotional Revolution, which is probably the single most important article published in Irish history in the last 50 years. He argued that what really happened was that Catholicism became a kind of a surrogate language of national identity in Ireland to replace what had actually been swept away by the famine and indeed by the longer term hollowing out effect of colonialism. And then the question becomes, in the second half of the 19th century, the British then say to him, look, you guys are wearing our clothes, was reading our newspapers, you're representing our parliament. How the hell can you say you're Irish or kind of distinctive? And the Irish answer to that then increasingly becomes, well, we're different from you because you guys are Protestant, but we're Catholic. And second half of the 19th century, Catholicism powerfully re-emerges with this much more bourgeois, much more Roman Catholic rather than Gaelic Catholic. And then on the other side of it, the Catholic Church also begins to take on the British state and to take over the welfare functions of the state. So like it begins to want to control education, wants to control hospitals, wants to control kind of life from the cradle to the crutch, as it were, and moves in as a sympathetic force because the state up to that was seen as a negative, external and hostile to the Irish people, whereas Catholicism could position itself as sympathetic to the people.
Yeah. Well, that whole idea of the Catholic Church becoming sort of a central part of nationalist identity, if you want to call it that, and replacing to a large extent the sort of cultural Gaelic identity. And the Catholic Church were very aware of that and were anti-Gaelic and anti-Irish language almost everywhere in the country because the evangelical Protestant movement went to the trouble of providing their
King James Bible in Irish.
In Irish. And a lot of the material that they made, they preached in Irish, whereas the Catholic Church hadn't. And in various places, it was the local poet who was the one who was made available as the teacher, and the Catholic Church in, for example, South Armagh, there's a wonderful book by Padraig Eolaithe about the Oriel area and how virulent the Catholic clergy were against the use of Irish because they saw it as going down the road to helping people become Protestant.
What impact did the post-Hammond Church have on Irish sexuality? Was it the convenient nexus of a need for population control? We can't let this population get out of hand anymore. Meeting religious prurience and intolerance, do you think?
One way of looking at that would be to kind of say that one of the impacts of the famine was to create a kind of a predisposition towards slight later marriage. Earlier, when the potato was going well and when they were subdividing within the Rundell system, as I described earlier, one of the key things that facilitated was early marriage and maybe marriage for what we might now think of as love, that people chose their own partners. What happens in the second half of the 19th century is as this much grimmer, harsher kind of world takes place, that now there's much more focus on marrying, you know, where you're marrying for resources. The dowry comes in very, very powerfully, for example. But what also happens then is that the age of marriage gets older, and in second half of the 19th century, I once looked at the 1901 census for Mulnahone in Tipperary. And what was really striking there is the vast bulk of men and women were, when they were married, were of very different ages, and that men were sometimes, quite a few of them, were the vast bulk of marriages, the men were 10 to 20 years older than the women. And I think then if you look at that, what then happened was that marriages, rather than being a partnership of equal, became the one where the father was the kind of authoritarian kind of figure. Maybe even the mother then becomes the kind of caregiver and the emotionally nurturing kind of one. And you get this whole kind of Irish mammy kind of syndrome emerging out of it. And what you then get is that the structure within the Irish family then becomes one where masculinity is constructed in a particular kind of way, to use the jargon. So the father becomes kind of authoritarian, cold, runs things outside the house. The mother becomes the kind of caregiver within the house. Then the children within that structure become, you know, it's very difficult for a son there, for example, you know, because he has to kind of hang on for a long time. And then you often get conflict between father and son. Then you get the younger children being emigrated, one for the farm, the rest for the road. And, you know, you then get a kind of a culture solidifying, which is brilliantly, I think, diagnosed by, let us say, a novelist like John McGarren, that the emotional economy of the family, the Irish family, the psychodynamics of it, the gender relationships and sexuality, and also perhaps also a kind of a sexuality which has a kind of a dark edge to it. If we want to kind of look at where, say, family abuse and where problems within families emerge, it's perhaps in ways it comes out of that kind of structure which emerges post-famine. Whereas pre-famine, again, it's difficult to access this, shall we say, but pre-famine, there's not that same sense of pressure and darkness and gloom within the family. So, you know, again, looking at the long-run evolution of the Irish family and the psychodynamics in particular of the Irish family, again, I think you can say that there are particular social and familial and kinship structures which emerge as a response to the famine, which do determine a particular kind of structure of feeling within the family.
Something else that happened was there was a huge increase in the numbers of priests and nuns. Now, that may be a function of the ending of subdivision and, you know, you've got nowhere to go, so you join the priesthood in the way that you might have emigrated or joined the army or whatever. But did this sense, Colm, do you think, Kevin has already already talked about the increasing power on the part of clerics. Did it lead to that sense of invulnerability and entitlement that is evident in the clerical abuse revelations from the 1990s onwards?
Yes, I think that the church was, as Kevin says, the only institution that held that sort of power. I mean, it's one of the reasons when people ask how come so many Irish people became, for example, writers, that literacy became really important in the second half of the 19th century. In every family, the mother is at home saying to the children, one thing you all have to do is learn to read and write. Read and writing in this house, even we've nothing else, get your pen and paper out. The idea that the only way out for you is the church. The only way in which you are going to become anybody is by becoming a priest. If you want power in this country, the only way you're going to get power is if you're a peasant farmer or if you're a tenant or if you're an evicted tenant, is by the possibility at some point of becoming a priest. And this also means you have to become literate.
Just to move on to something else, the Irish language. It was already in decline, but it waned further and faster during and after the famine, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I suppose if you're looking at the way in which society was unevenly affected by the famine, the Irish-speaking population, which even then was largely to the west, was decimated. Perhaps 500,000 Irish speakers would have disappeared during the famine. It also left an aftertaste where I remember coming across an account, I think maybe from Tipperary, and someone was talking about language change in the area and said, oh, yeah, they used to speak Irish around here. And he was talking about the family. But there was America and bread in it. People saw that the way out was either mostly to the United States, some to Canada, or otherwise to Liverpool, Manchester or Glasgow, depending on what part of the country you came from, which were all English-speaking areas. That coincided as well with the national school system, which was teaching literacy in English and only in English. So people, if they hadn't felt it before, and they may well have felt it because there was gradual language change happening, I think that the famine and the unequal way in which it hit the poorer populations and the Irish-speaking populations on the Western seaboard put another nail in that coffin.
I think that the whole Irish literary revival at the end of the 19th century, for example, is a delayed effect response to the famine. Because what was the literary revival about? It was essentially about creating a version of a distinctive Ireland, but in the English language. And whereas the whole earlier thing, you didn't have to worry about that. You know, if you go to Montreal in Canada or whatever, you know, they're not a bit bothered about whether you see them as Americans or Canadians. But if you go to English-speaking Canada, they're obsessed with, you know, if you happen to accidentally kind of consider that they're American, you know, they're up in arms. But, you know, if you have your own language, you're very secure in that identity. The displacement of the language then creates this kind of vacuum. And the whole work of the literary revival, and, you know, including things like the Gaelic Athletic Association, the Land League, the Abbey Theatre, the tremendous experimentation in the novel form, in poetry, all of that comes out of an effort to create a new version of Ireland, which is distinctive.
I suppose I'd like to just take up the issue of the Abbey Theatre apart from the other ones and just look at the way in which the Abbey Theatre, for example, handled the famine. In 1847, in the House of Commons, Sir William Gregory introduced a clause which was really important, which said that if you went into the workhouse, you would have to give up your lease.
Pretty much.
Now, in the House of Commons debate in those days, it was pointed out to him this would really result in mass clearances and that people would simply be ruined. Lady Gregory wasn't born then. I mean, she's born 5 years later, but she married him. The problem she had in 1892 on his death was that she was his widow. And she'd inherited his legacy and she had his son. So that she was in a very ambiguous position once the end of the century comes, in which she's both the landlady, the widow of Sir William Gregory, and she's beginning to think about the idea of a sort of revival in the English language of a sort of idealism via the theatre in Ireland. And Yeats, for example, wrote his play about the famine, The Countess Kathleen, in 1892. Now, it was performed in the Abbey in 1911, but he didn't write another play about the famine. Lady Gregory's influence was an extraordinarily pervasive one. She read every text that came into that theatre until her death in 1932. The theatre, in creating images of the new society, which it did again and again, not only in the ones we know, I mean, The Sing and O'Casey, but week after week in putting on new plays, that simply these issues, the issue of land, the issue of the famine, was not going to be part of the national agenda as set up in the National Theatre under Lady Gregory's care, because she was in this very, very particular position. So that the silence around the famine, in one case, it arose from a single woman in immense position of power. We're not going to call a bridge after her. We're not going to call anything after her, simply because she was so powerful. She moved in the shadows being powerful. She read every text. And that, for example, the Sings made their living from owning land, from having rents. Some of Singh's actual siblings were involved in evictions. So you have an extraordinary moment in Irish culture where the architects of the new culture, of the revival, are themselves deeply implicated in the eradication of the culture to which they're most wishing to adhere to or celebrate. It's a most peculiar position. It gives us art. I mean, art comes out of those sort of ambiguities sometimes, but it's a very interesting and peculiar position.
But still, you know, you have Lady Gregory with her helpers and translators collecting the Irish language oral tradition in her own area around Gort. You have Singh going off to the Aran Islands and off to the Great Blasket to learn Irish.
And you have Lady Gregory collecting her rents in the same week, and at one point threatening eviction to the very people she was collecting.
You could say, and my colleague Seamus Dean has said this, that Ireland after the famine, in the generation after the famine, was kind of culturally comatose. It was almost as if it was kind of shell-shocked. But then the generation that seizes responsibility for the famine is the generation that was actually born during it. So you look at Michael Davitt, he's 1847, the founder of the GAA. Michael Cusack is 1848. There's a whole generation which comes on board, and they begin systematically to take responsibility for trying to repair the damage and fill the hole that had been created by the famine. And that whole energy, the incredible energy of that generation from 1880 up to 1916. You know, I think all of it is a delayed effect response to actually trying to handle what had happened during the famine.
Okay, now the diaspora itself, of course, wasn't really acknowledged in Irish history and identity probably until the 1990s, when, as President of Ireland, Mary Robinson highlighted their importance. When I spoke to her for this series, she recalled how this was received at the time.
I found that the commemoration of the famine during those 3 years was an incredible way to link with the wider Irish family, the Irish diaspora. I had made a speech in the Oireachtas about the diaspora, which was not appreciated either by members of the House or of the Oireachtas, or indeed immediately in Ireland, but it resonated hugely with the Irish diaspora. It is something that I believe is in our DNA, and it's in the DNA of those who have left Ireland, even those who are now second or third generation. They know about the Great Famine. They know that we had this extraordinary decimation of our nation through death and through dispersal, and that somehow we were resilient and came through, and that it has given us an empathy with suffering and with difficulties of developing countries.
Now, Mary Robinson's own empathy contributed to unprecedented official Irish sympathy for asylum seekers, for example. In the mid-1990s, people might forget this, but Bertie Ahern said that our suffering in the last century has given us an understanding and sympathy for those still suffering in other countries today. Of course, it didn't last, obviously. As a country, Colm, though, have we in any sense learned compassion and empathy for other ailing nations through our own experience of the famine, do you think?
I mean, one of the really beautiful things about America is that if you're born in America, you're American. If your parents are Chinese in Ireland and they don't have citizenship and you're born in Ireland, you have nothing. That you're, oddly enough, from nowhere, suddenly the matter of blood comes into it. And it seems to me that we've learned only caution, only fear. If they want our sympathy, of course, we'll send them sympathy. But if they want rights, we won't give them rights. We somehow are the descendants of those who died in the famine, that we're the victims. Therefore, everybody must look to us if they want victims. We don't want other victims coming into us and perhaps taking some of our social welfare or our beds in hospitals or our places in schools. That we have learned nothing that has helped us to become a better place with a more forward-looking or with greater sympathy for the outside world.
Well, I would fundamentally disagree with Colm there. If you look at Ireland in a European context now, what is the most striking feature of contemporary Ireland? And one of them is that we are one of the very few countries in Europe which haven't actually spawned a xenophobic, anti-immigrant right-wing kind of reaction. Part of that is because most Irish people do have an experience of emigration or have been in other countries, and that there is something within our kind of wider culture which remains sympathetic to other countries and other cultures and whatever. If you look at other cultures, it's much more virulent than it is in ours.
OK, I want to finish on the topic of memorialisation. Around the 150th anniversary of the famine, a plethora of memorials and monuments started appearing here and abroad. One of the acclaimed memorials sits in the middle of the skyscrapers of downtown Lower Manhattan. It's actually a replica of a famine farm, a small hill of grass and shrubs with a roofless stone cottage tucked into the landscape. Artist Brian Toll was chosen to create the New York Memorial in 2000 as a piece of sculpture. Nicolene Greer went to visit it with him.
We're entering, we came through a passage. Now the passage here is inspired by ancient Celtic architecture, so the court cairns and the passage tombs, the idea that there's an east-west orientation here, and that you come through the passage and you end up in what would have been, in those ancient buildings, you know, the sunlit or the skylit chamber.
A small ruined stone cottage is not what you would expect to sit side by side with the New York Stock Exchange and the New World Trade Center. The Irish Hunger Memorial was created by artist Brian Toll. He visited Ireland, and it was on the West Coast that he found the inspiration for how the project would be realized.
Visited these deserted places, places like Schlievemoor on Achill Island, the deserted village there, and really was struck by the profound absence. There's a kind of quiet in these places that is overwhelmingly powerful. So I knew, having visited Schlievemoor, that a cabin or a house of that sort was essential to the project. And my partner, Brian Klein, is Irish in every direction. Actually, his family's from Mayo, and we were going through old photo albums with his mom, and there was a photograph of his grandmother in front of the family cottage. And I thought, well, that looks very much like the sort of house we've been looking for.
And so, a whole ruined cottage was transported from Attimas in Mayo to Battery Park City in New York and put back together by specially trained stonemasons.
The original fireplace here has no flue, but I guess one of the primary functions of the fire was to keep the thatch dry. There's an old Irish proverb that says, when the fire goes out, the roof caves in. And that became a very, very powerful statement during the famine era, because so many families, Catholic families, Christian families, the idea of dying and not being properly buried was unimaginable. And so there are many, many accounts of people, the last person to survive within a family basically just closed the door, and the fire would go out and the roof would in fact cover them and become their graves.
Like Rowan Gillespie's sculpture beside the IFSC in Dublin, the Irish Hunger Memorial sits beside the financial district of New York City.
This project is on the Hudson River in the middle of Lower Manhattan. It's quite an expensive piece of real estate. The building to your to the south of us is the New York Mercantile Exchange, where all of the commodities in the United States are traded. So the idea that they look out on an abandoned Irish field that's here to commemorate a traumatic event in terms of world hunger is an extraordinary thing.
As you come out of the cottage, you enter a small grassy area planted with plants like blackthorn and heath.
You can see that there are mounds here that, you know, referencing the drills, the potato drills, but there's no potatoes growing here. This is a place of absence. This is a place that saw tremendous loss. You know, you could come here on a day as cold and damp as this one, and we're the only two people standing here, and so you can feel the complete desolation and the absence of a human presence in this place. But there are days in the summertime, for example, when tour bus after tour bus comes past this place, and there might be 200 people wandering about, and in that case, you can feel the pressure on this landscape. And so the population dwindles and grows and dwindles and grows, and I think for me that's the poetry of the place.
Kevin?
The place to me that is most resonant and evocative is Gros Isle in Quebec, where you're in the St. Lawrence River, and which was the quarantine station. And you know, these ships, when they come up the St. Lawrence, they used to say, You could smell them 10 miles before they kind of came up because, you know, some of the worst ships and the coffin ships and whatever went up the St. Lawrence. And even to the present day, it's an incredibly poignant and evocative place to be, in part because the graves in it, they're not a memorial, they're the actual graves. They have an incredible look of the lazy beds of the famine period. And when you're out there in the mist and on the fog in Gros Eel, like you just, I feel anyway, and any Irish person I think that goes there feels that, you just feel suddenly very close and very present with the thing. In part, as I say, because it's not a monument per se. The whole island is itself a kind of a place of a memory and a site of memory. And I think, you know, when Mary Robinson and others visited there, like everybody has a kind of a, any Irish person that I've ever known that's visited it has this kind of visceral reaction to it. And it also has this incredible other story because the Canadian government used it as a, essentially in the Second World War, as a place to test anthrax and different kind of things. So it has this kind of slightly eerie, gothic kind of thing. And as I say, you're very, very aware there that you're in the presence of, you know, something which profoundly connects with our country, which is so far away from it in other ways. And it's always added to again then, I think, by the fact that you have to cross water to get to it. So you kind of feel you're crossing the River Styx.
OK, I want to finish with the what if question. Our population was decimated, well, more than decimated by the famine. And even today, we are the only country in Europe, possibly the only country in the world with a smaller population than we had in 1840. If we never had the famine, if we had remained perhaps Irish speaking, who knows, if we didn't have emigration, what kind of country would we have now?
I think one of the key things that the famine does, and the famine and the next 50 years of emigration, is to simplify the class structure in Ireland. This 3 million people who were removed would have provided a kind of a base for a different kind of politics and maybe a more...
So the Russian Revolution might have happened here.
The Russian Revolution might have happened here. And again, in the Irish context, what is very striking then is that the Cultural Revolution preceded it rather than postdated it. And that's what allows the Irish state to be so conservative when it emerged. And in essence, the famine had done the kind of the social work of a revolutionary project by rejigging the social structure.
Cahill.
If the least well-off part of society had lived through the famine, would it have changed the whole structure of society? Perhaps the rebellion that we had in 1916 would have happened earlier, would have been of a different hue. Who knows?
Colin?
I think the dream would have to be, if you look, for example, at Spain, if you look at the way the Basques went bilingual, Catalans remained bilingual. And the idea for us that with this population, that the language would not have been lost, or would not have been lost in the way it's been lost, and that the country would have become bilingual, and that the East would have become sort of westernised slowly, just by dint of people moving from the West to the East, and that you would actually have a bilingual Ireland. I think that has to remain a great what if, and a great loss, I think.
Cathal Porter, Colm Tobin and Kevin Whelan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. On this programme, we've heard historians, writers, psychiatrists and a scientist, to name but a few, giving their views on the legacy that the famine has left us. And there's a clear difference of opinion on some of the areas of Irish life it has or has not affected. But one thing is certain, it gives us a lot to think about. So is this country still scarred by the famine? What do you think? From me, Miles Dungan, and producer Yeti Redmond, goodbye. And thanks for listening.
Blighted Nation with Miles Dungan on RTE Radio 1. You can podcast this programme and find more information at rte.ie/blightednation.